So that is an introduction to Brother Dan's second class, His Short War. Brother Dan.
Well, thank you for coming back again. I wasn't quite sure if you were going to after that first one. And as Brother Sean said, after the 11,572 different types of snacks that were out there, I was speaking to the other Brother Dan, who after this I think I'll call Brother Dan 2. And he was saying, we have to watch out because, you know, about 35 minutes from now, we'll all have a bit of a sugar crash. So what I'll try and do is give you something to sort of wake you up about that point. If you can sort of hang in with me till the end, I will try and give you a story about me in tears, in business class, while drinking champagne on an aeroplane. And hopefully that'll wake you up. Okay, so we talked earlier about our vision and about that need to have, if you will, a dream, an image of the future that can help propel us forward. We talked about, I guess, the importance of clothing our future with reality. And I think each of us in our own way, we can sense the way that the world around us, it's buffeting us. We all know that we're in treacherous seas. And as the storms close around us, having that vision of our final destination, of the place we're trying to get to, that serves to guide us and to bear us along. What we want to do is have a look at what does that. What is it that pushes us along? And Peter has something really interesting to say on this, because the Apostle Peter talked of prophecy and he described it as a light that guides us through the darkness to the dawn. And the apostle concludes by telling us that the prophets spoke as they were moved by what the Spirit conveyed through them. And what I love about this passage is that word moved there in that passage, or the word carried along, it's exactly the same word that's used in this passage, Acts chapter 27 verse 15. It's used in this passage to describe the way Paul's vessel was driven by the great storm Euryclidon, pummeled, forced, thrown through the waves. And a vision of our future can do this, brothers and sisters. It can drive us through the stormiest of seas. And so this afternoon, I hope there's going to be a moment, there's going to be a thought or a snapshot that can serve as pigment for your vision and can help drive you forwards at times when it feels like you're in an ocean of doubt. When we finished our last session, we were there in the company of the saints. We were basking in the glow of our King's smile, while outside the world began to descend into madness. And we're going to cover some material today that we'll sort of recover and repackage a little bit in our lecture on Sunday night. But nonetheless, Revelation chapter 16 verse 14 describes for us the invasive, almost corrosive, corrupting influence that's going to drive all nations, the whole world, to the valley that has awaited the kingdoms of men since Nimrod first defied God. When our captain gave these words here to John all those years ago, he used language that would take the minds of those who followed his lead to one story in the Bible and one story alone. This language was designed to take the minds of his listeners to one place, and only one place, because he described spirits, doesn't he? the influences upon the world. He describes them as spirits of devils. And in so doing, he uses a very, very specific word. And it turns out that this word shows up just once outside Revelation. And in just one story. And to make sure that we don't miss the point, it occurs in all three gospel records that record that story. This one singular word. The word is only ever used of legion. Legion. Legion was a man so insane that chains could not bind him. Just think of that. A man who raged amongst the tombs. A man who was a danger to himself and all near him. And this word unmistakably serves to direct our attention to that story and that story alone. As we work to understand the madness that will craze our world. Our captain, during his ministry, cured many. Many who were described as demon-afflicted. But in every single other story in which he cured someone with a demon, the word used is daimonion. It's daimonion. And that means demon-influenced. Now, we know that these words do not describe a supernatural entity, but that being said, the word used here in Luke chapter 8 and verse 29 of Legion describes one not merely influenced or affected by a demon. No, not a daimonian. No, it describes someone who had a demon, who possessed or was possessed of a demon. Legion was not just influenced by demons. He, in the Greek, he had one. Poor Legion was afflicted and crazed with a cacophony of malignant, self-harming, destructive voices that were screaming night and day within the skull of his head. He was insane, this man. And this is an idea, insanity, that has less to do with something medical and much more to do with something legal. In law, an insanity defense lies in proving that the defendant could not distinguish right from wrong when they committed the crime. It speaks of moral blindness. And it's this image that our Lord wanted to present alongside the picture of the world. When Christ said to John, look, there's going to be a spirit of demons. And used words only used of Legion and no one else. He was trying to say to us, look at Legion and you will understand our world. You will understand the thing that drives our planet relentlessly and implacably to world war. You will understand when you look at this man. It speaks of this moral blindness of a man driven to crazed violence by the relentless cacophony of contradictory voices that scream all the time, 24 hours by 7 in his head. And this man was so maddened by these voices that he cannot tell good from evil. He cannot tell right from wrong. And if this isn't, brothers and sisters, if this isn't the perfect description of the strange and twisted years that we live in right now, I can't think of a better way. Can you? Our world, relentlessly, the leaders, the provincial government, the state government, the national government, being relentlessly pummeled by thousands of contradictory voices, all screaming to them about what they ought to do until they can't tell right from wrong, and most of the decisions they make are just downright wrong. That's what's happening, isn't it? Well, look, I don't know about Canada. Maybe you got it better than we have. But I doubt it. Our society, our institutions, our leaders, our governments are beset by thousands of voices, 1,000 interest groups. As society fragments into these smaller and smaller but louder and louder tribes, each is enabled by the platform provided by the internet, their voices amplified by the media. Each faction and each activist group is convinced that it's their cause that is right. Their cause is more important than all of the others. Their cause should be heard at the cost of all the others and obeyed at the expense of everything. There's Antifa and social justice warriors. There's incels and LGBTQI and militant feminism and male defense and white rights and Black Lives Matter and Me Too and Free Palestine. And each group screams so loudly that the kings of the earth cannot tell right from wrong. And they find themselves all at war one day. In, of all places, Israel. And we know from countless lectures that it is the leader of Russia that fires the first shots in this war of mutual insanity. And this war is described for us graphically, if you like, in Ezekiel chapter 38. Let's go there. I know you've been there a lot of times before, but let's go to Ezekiel 38 again together, please. Now, I don't plan to go through Ezekiel 38 in any great detail if you're worried. Rather, we're here because Ezekiel 38 provides for us insights into those first shots of the war of Armageddon. Ezekiel 38, if you like, gives us the why, gives us the who and the how, and it serves as a sort of framework into which we can, as we go, fit other passages. So let's start with the why. Ezekiel tells us in verse 10 through to verse 12, that it'll come to pass that they will think an evil thought. They'll think an evil thought. He describes the reasoning of those that invade as evil, as wicked. This invader sees those who are being invaded as prey, as those who are unable to defend themselves. They see them as easy pickings for plunder. And it's not just that their prey is defenseless. Who their prey is matters as well. They're not just any old defenseless nation, but specifically the ones they're invading, verse 11 and 12 tell us, are those who are gathered out of the nations. That is, the Jews. So, firstly, easy pickings. That's about a financial motivation. But secondly, they're motivated clearly by a racial motive as well. There's raw, rabid anti-Semitism here. And then verse 8 flags for us another motivation as well. Another feature of their enemy's prey stands out to the enemy. The enemy, when he looks at who he is going to invade, describes himself as coming against the mountains. And Ezekiel 36, a little bit early on, has this to add. He says that the enemy will say, aha, the ancient, not just mountains, high places are ours in possession. This is, if you like, the dialogue in Gog's evil thoughts. It's a third motivation. Yes, there's finance. Yes, there's racism. But there's also here a religious motive, isn't there? A new crusade to recover the ancient papal holy places from the Semites. So that's the why. Why are they doing it? Money, racism, religion. Now, Ezekiel also tells us who's in God's entourage, and we know the names, and we've sort of heard a lot of lectures about these over the years, but for the purposes of tonight, Nebuchadnezzar's vision in Daniel chapter 2 serves as a sort of useful foundation. Now, we usually explain Daniel chapter 2 as a kind of a vertical timeline, don't we? It's sort of listing off the history of the nations that would capture the Middle East territory, which included Israel. And what we do as we look at it is we see it as sort of this vertical timeline as each empire in its turn stands up and stands supreme for a brief period and is alone by itself for a time. But you see, when that happened, that's not really the vision that Nebuchadnezzar saw. You see, Nebuchadnezzar saw this. Nebuchadnezzar didn't see this. He didn't see the elements of his image winking in and out of existence, one after another, as they did in history. By the time the Persians were at full power, the Babylonians were gone. The Greeks replaced the Persians largely. The Romans conquered the Greeks. They didn't stand together. They appeared one after another. But what Nebuchadnezzar saw was that. All together. He saw them standing together. One united image astride the globe. And interpreting the dream, Daniel told Nebuchadnezzar that it wasn't a vision for Nebuchadnezzar's time. Daniel said, no, this is a vision for the latter days. A time when in the end, all of the constituent parts of this image empire would finally be shattered together by the stone. All or at one time together. That's important. Daniel 2 is primarily a vision of the future. And it shows us much of the territory which will fall under Gog's evil aegis after we are taken away to Sinai. So how does this Gog, this one at the top of the Russian kingdom, how does he achieve this union? You know, when you look at Russia's recent successes, you know, for Gog to achieve and to hold such enormous influence as this over so many countries, it's kind of hard to imagine, isn't it? Like you think, well, how would a leader from somewhere within the old Soviet Union come to such an influential position that they can tie in the whole of the European Union, not to mention fascist nations throughout the Middle East and Northern Africa? How? Well, clearly, many of the nations in Gog's axis will share common hungers, common evil thoughts, or share a hunger for money, perhaps a share a common racism, and a share and a desire for easy prey. But for others, a stronger force will be required to bind these fractured, brittle kingdoms into one. And we know what will do that. The remaining vestiges of Roman influence, the iron grip on the hearts and the souls of billions that has served as the only enduring belief in common in Europe's fraternity of nations. The focus of this belief is described in Revelation chapter 16 as the false prophet. the Pope, the self-proclaimed father of the faith, and his influence will be used to bind unwilling allies into lockstep with Russia. A weak, easily fragmented, part clay kingdom will be bound tight by old iron. But even still, there will be some that require yet further coercion to bind themselves to Gog's fortunes. There'll be nations like France, who are determined to do everything the Gallic way, the French way, not the Slavic way. And of them, Ezekiel 38 says that Gog will be a guard, a prison warden. Perhaps in some way they will be defeated or captured. And doubtless they will be obliged to fight beside the soldiers in green through treaty or because they themselves are a defeated conquest. And so the march south to war, to destiny and to destruction begins. We entitled this session, His Short War. But even though we've waited for this conflict, for these events, for our whole lifetimes, when this event finally arrives, it will likely be over very swiftly. Gog's occupation of the Middle East may last a while, perhaps even years, but once the events that we care about are started, the response of our captain, he will demonstrate his overwhelming power and superiority to the forces of the kingdom of men. And he'll do so in part through the speed with which he dispatches them and rescues Abraham's seed. And so we expect this conflict to take weeks, perhaps months, but not years. Not years of long, sort of equally matched conflict. That's not what's going to happen here. This is very unmatched conflict. The might of the God of heaven himself arrayed against the feeble weapons of all mankind. It will be over fast. It's a short war. And our reading of Daniel chapter 11 described the march of Gog southwards. But in the context of Daniel chapter 11, which of course is a chapter that describes the centuries-long war that raged back and forth between the empire north of Israel, that is the Seleucid Empire, and the empire south of Israel, the Ptolemies, in those terms, Gog takes the title of the King of the North. As the head of an empire to the north of Israel that commands the territory that was once possessed by the northern Seleucid Empire. And just like them, this empire pushes south through Daniel's land. The part of Daniel chapter 11, let's flick back there if you'd be so kind. The part of Daniel 11 verse 40 that remains still to be fulfilled predicts for us that in the time of the end, the northern emperor will begin his march south by pushing at a power described using some very ambiguous terms. In this verse, in verse 40, he's described as him. So the king of the north is marching southward and pushing against him. Who's him? Who's this him that the king of the north is pushing southward against? Well, from the detail surrounding this hymn's introduction in verse 36. We learn that this hymn is the king. Not the king of the north, not the king of the south, just the king. And we believe this person to be whichever ruler rules in Turkey, at least by the time verse 40 commences. And thus, Brother Thomas's remark that we've kind of already looked at, that we don't have to wait to see the Turks fall. That's where he got it from. He gets it from this verse, and he interprets the hymn in this verse 40 as being the Turks, whoever is ruling in Turkey. And he sees the king of the north, Russia, pushing against Turkey. And so the first conquest in the northern king's march south will be the ruler of Turkey. And then in verse 41, we can see that he continues his momentum southward. He keeps on marching southward. Given that remark in verse 41, where he talks about Edom, Moab, and the chief of Ammon's cities, that is, those cities that are in ancient Ammon's south, escaping. You might think, well, Edom, Ammon, Moab, who's that? Well, today we would say that's Jordan. That's modern day Jordan. And so what we've been told in verse 41 is that as this king of the north, led by the Russians, marches south from Turkey, Jordan is not captured and defeated. Not yet. And the next verse informs us that the key strategic objective of this king's march south is to secure Egypt. You might think, why Egypt? I mean, what's Egypt got that they want? I mean, it's not like you can take the pyramids home to Russia. What do you get in Egypt? Well, as far as I know, food poisoning. Right? But verse 43 goes on to talk about the treasures of gold and silver. And amazingly, over the last few years, a startling number of precious metal discoveries have been made under Egypt's shifting sands. But also, the invader, we're told, seeks Egypt's precious things. And its most precious thing, over which it almost started World War in the 1950s, is the Suez Canal. Arguably the most lucrative, the most crucial waterway on the planet. Yet, in verse 44, having captured Egypt, something makes this northern invader hesitate. Makes him turn back. Tidings. So what is it that emerges in the north? And what is it that emerges in the east that causes him concern and pulls him back up north, leaving just a garrison behind to police his Egyptian conquest? Well, I'd like to suggest to you that it's the tidings are Tarshish and the young lions, together with Sheba and Dedan, this is the language of Ezekiel 38, moving to check the northern king's progress. Britain will be most likely almost exactly due north of Cairo in Cyprus. For even today, the sovereign base areas of, and I'll pronounce these completely wrong if you've been there, but Akrotiri and Dhekelia, they are sovereign British territories that serve as important British military presence in the Middle East. And you can see I've marked in pink the amount of Britain that is still in Cyprus today. They call it their non-mobile aircraft carrier. And so that is almost due north of Cairo. And so the tidings out of the north perhaps are a build-up on this island. Well, perhaps the reason that Jordan survives the southern march of Russia may well be due to the presence of forces coming up from Sheba and Dedan. Oh, Sheba and Dedan, well, as we talked to the young people the other night, Sheba represents the nations at the bottom of the Saudi Peninsula, perhaps nations like Yemen and Qatar and UAE, while Dedan speaks of Saudi Arabia. And those nations are already beginning their movement to ally with Britain. Their presence and their military significance is growing. And so what we've got here is imagery that says that Britain and the Arabic nations in the area together appear to move to flank the king of the north's position in Israel. And it is this that causes him to march back north again in great fury. On the way south, his army kind of transited Israel. Perhaps they charged down the highways, but left Israel largely untouched. But now, heading back north again, they are determined to eliminate all resistance that may cause them problems and to crush all who would brook them in Israel and to meet their original objectives before having to face other foes. And this is really where our involvement begins. Isaiah 19 describes the Lord riding into Egypt on a bright, glowing cloud. And in the following verses, it describes the disasters that have already befallen Egypt before his arrival. There's been a civil war. There's the rule of a cruel northern invader and some terrible climate catastrophe. And now, when he has finished his wonderful work at Sinai, our general emerges from Sinai, our king and our general, and he leads us northwest from Sinai to Egypt. This here is really the beginning of the march of the rainbowed angel as described in Revelation chapter 10 and verse 1. And just as Isaiah's Lord rides a glorious cloud, so John's mighty angel is clothed with a cloud, representing God's glory that is now present in you and me, for we are immortal saints. So why does Christ go to Egypt first? Well, Zechariah chapter 12 establishes for us a principle that God moves to save Jewry first. And likely, what's happened is that Gog's march south has pushed a wave of Jewish refugees ahead of him, who've then found themselves trapped in Egypt, between the Nile and the trackless deserts beyond. And so it makes sense that our king and a commander heads for Egypt, that he might be the savior, the great one promised in Isaiah chapter 19, and particularly verse 20. And so our king goes to Egypt. This battle capture Egypt and rescue refugee Jews is the first of three battles in the War of Armageddon. And of this first blow by Christ against the kingdom of men, we don't know a lot. There's not a lot of description about how this one plays out. There's probably only a garrison of Russian soldiers remaining at Gog's rearguard. And so likely this conflict is fairly insignificant, certainly in comparison to the two crushing encounters that will follow. And so there's not a lot of detail about how this great victory is won in Egypt. What is described for us is the path of our departure from Egypt. For Christ, we're told, will take the same route as Moses did so long ago, out towards Pi-hahiroth, and then he takes a sharp left turn through the depths of the sea. And we said we'd come back to this passage, didn't we? Here we are, Psalm 68. The Lord said, I will bring again from Bashan. I will bring my people again from the depths of the sea. This is not an isolated passage. Isaiah 51 says this, awake, awake, put on strength, O man, O arm of Yahweh. Awake, as in the ancient days, do again what you did in the time of old, in the generation of old. Art thou not it which hath out of Rahab and wounded the dragon? Art thou not it which hath dried the sea, the waters of the great deep, that hath made the depths of the sea a way for the ransom to pass over? And here in Isaiah again is a call to Yahweh to make once more the depths of the sea a way, a place that those who are rescued can pass through. Tell you what, I know it's hard on a warm summer's afternoon, but if you're looking for something to inspire you and to wake you up, how about this? How about the experience of leading a recently saved refugee community of mortal Jews through the Red Sea, going over dry shod through those towering canyons of water? Can you imagine doing that as you walk? Oh, look, there's a shark. Can you imagine seeing their wonder, their awe, and their growing faith, and feeling in yourself a similar awe and wonder? And by the way, if this is not enough for you, Brother Thomas infers from the lack of prophetic comment on the saints' interaction with the Red Sea on their way to Egypt in the first place, that lacking any mortals in this company, the company coming from Sinai to Egypt being entirely immortals, he infers that the whole company of saints take the simplest and most direct route from Sinai to Egypt. What's that? Well, that's walking across the water, as our Lord did long ago on the Sea of Galilee. Imagine that. We're on our way to Egypt to save the seed of Abraham for the second time and to lead them back through the baptizing waters of the Red Sea. But on the way, we walk on water. I think it'll be amazing. And so the first engagement between the kingdom of God and the kingdom of men is short, sharp, it's decisive, it results in the rescue of many of the seed of Abraham, but it's now over, and our Lord leads us northwards. Having fought a battle to free his people from Egypt, as Moses did, and having opened a way through the sea, like Moses did, our captain now leads us out into the wilderness, for a battle waits him there, as it did Moses, the battle of Bozrah. So let's go there. Let's have a look at that. Let's go to Isaiah chapter 35. And yes, get those fingers moving and that blood flowing to help us through this weary session. Isaiah 35. This is a kingdom passage that we know well. We sing this hymn so very often, don't we? The rose shall blossom in the desert place, a wilderness shall sing with cries of joy. But the context of this passage, I think we're a little bit less familiar with it. At least I was. Who, in verse 1, it says, the wilderness and the solitary place shall be glad for them. Who's the them? Who's the them that these desert places are glad because of? Well, chapter 34, verse 11, in fact, verse 11 onwards tells us that it's the desert creatures who inherit this empty land. The cormorant and the bittern and the owl. It's them that the desert is glad for. And it says, but, do you see that? At the verse, chapter 34, verse 11, but the cormorant and the bittern that the deserts will rejoice for when they blossom, but they possess it. And of course, but's a continuing phrase. And the point I'm trying to make is there's a flow of thought from the beginning of chapter 34 into chapter 35. The possession of the desert places by the cormorant and the bittern and others that the wilderness will rejoice for is in contrast to prior events, hence that word but. And the prior events are recorded, well, verse 2, the indignation of Yahweh is upon all nations. His fury is upon their armies. He has utterly destroyed them. He has delivered them to slaughter. Verse 6, the sword of Yahweh is filled with blood. It is made fat with fatness and with the blood of lambs and goats, with the fat of kidneys of rams. For Yahweh has a great sacrifice in Bozrah and a great slaughter in the land of Idumea. Verse 9, the streams thereof will be turned to pitch, the dust thereof to brimstone, the land thereof shall become burning pitch. This wilderness had once been occupied by the enemies of Zion, by the representatives of the kingdom of men, but Christ, he will encounter these armies on his march northward, and he will return the possession of this wild place to the desert animals once more. Isaiah 63 and verse 1 through to 4 describes this same encounter. And you see, while the battle of the Nile, as we might call it, was short, perhaps occupying a week or so, and while that may have sort of escaped the notice of the world, it's not a particularly big deal, and it may well not have been front page news. This battle at Bozrah will be different. Because this battle marks the beginning of open war between our commander and the kingdom of men. Now, we don't have time today to follow this thread, but it appears that Britain and her allies may have moved into this area of Bozrah just south of the Dead Sea. And perhaps they hear rumors of the events in Egypt. In Isaiah chapter 16, the possessor of Moab, that is the modern day Jordanians, in which Bozrah resides, are exhorted to seek the help of the future ruler of Zion by sending him a mark of submission out into the wilderness. So they're told here in this passage that they should send this gift out into the wilderness to the place where they would expect this person who has won a victory in Egypt to be coming from. Sadly, it appears that pride prevents these forces, even though they're opposing Gog as well, just as Christ do, it prevents them from this act of humility. And so there at Bozrah, Christ will strike a devastating blow against the pride of Tarshish and her allies. For Christ, they also are just another part of the kingdom of men. Well, that's battle number two. Now, once more, we march north again, following the path of Moses out to the east of the Dead Sea, and then we take a sharp left again, up the coast and across Jordan. No doubt we will be dry-footed as we cross the Jordan, just as Joshua was, and then up the steep incline from Jericho towards the Mount of Olives. Would you be kind enough to come to Zechariah 14, please? Zechariah 14. If there were any battle that could be called Armageddon on its own, this one in Zechariah 14 is it. It's described in verse 1 as the day of the Lord. Joel happens to describe it in Joel chapter 3 as, well, a harvest, a threshing, a heap of sheaves ready to be threshed. Now, we don't know the precise location of the Valley of Jehoshaphat described in Joel. There are many theories, but we do know exactly where this battle is won and how, because Zechariah 14 verse 1 to 4 tells us, "Behold, the day of the Lord comes," speaking to Israel, "and your spoil shall be divided in the midst of you. And I will gather all nations against Jerusalem to battle. The city shall be taken, the houses rifled, the women ravished, half the city shall go forth into captivity, and the residue of the people shall not be cut off from the city. Then shall Yahweh go forth and fight against those nations as when he fought in the day of battle." That is the day of battle in the time of Joshua. "And his feet shall stand in that day upon the Mount of Olives, which is before Jerusalem on the east. And the Mount of Olives shall cleave in the midst thereof towards the east and towards the west. And there shall be a very great valley, and half the mountain shall remove towards the north and half towards the south. And ye shall flee." A tremendous and cataclysmic earthquake finishes this great war, finishes what is left of Tarshish and the young lions, finishes Gog and his army of nations, finishes all resistance to Christ in Israel. And we will address this a little bit further in our next session. But after this great blow rends the earth, battle will commence on a smaller scale, on the scale of earlier battles that God was involved in, like Joshua's and Gideon's and David's, running battles throughout the mountains of Israel as an enemy that is shaken but not yet completely broken is purged from Messiah's land. And you might say, well, who fights these battles? And the answer is, we do. Psalm 149 talks about the saints engaged in this conflict, and Ezekiel 38 describes the weapons with which our commander will arm us. And here's one of them. It says, "I will plead against them with pestilence, with blood. I will rain upon him and upon his bands and upon his many people that are with him, an overflowing rain and great hailstones, lightning and brimstone." Let's just think about that. Have you ever felt hurt at the blasphemous treatment of God by a thoughtless world? You ever sit there and think, how can they make that law? Or how can they say these things, advertise that? Have you ever wanted to strike a blow against the world that oppresses the poor and the needy, thoughtlessly crushing those at the bottom of society deeper into the dirt? You want to strike back against those who evangelize vile, godless practices or promote racist, anti-Semitic hatred? Because this is that moment. This is the moment when, commanded by a great judge, we wreak vengeance on behalf of God's people and God's land. And imagine using these weapons: rain, brimstone, lightning, hail, surgical vengeance falling at our command. And again, we talked to the young people about this last night, but there is some property of hail that is reserved. I hope you'll forgive the dad joke on this slide, but there's some property of the hail that is reserved for the day of judgment. Something about hail has been hidden for the Battle of Armageddon. And what is it? What property of hail is reserved? Well, the other night I gave the young people a suggestion. It turns out that one of the properties of hail that is quite remarkable and is very rarely seen but real is the vast size that it turns out that hail can get to. Great hail. One in Brazil was measured to be 200 kilograms. Can anyone do a conversion into pounds for me? What is that in pounds? 140? 440 pounds of ice falling out of the sky. Now, let me tell you, if that hits you, it's going to give you a very bad day. Right? Amazing. And when it's falling, it's traveling at over 141 kilometers. This one, 200 kilograms, 440 pounds, was traveling at over 141 kilometers per hour when it hit. Imagine the impact crater that thing made. A chunk of hail, 440 pounds. This is not imaginary, it happened. And here's the weird thing about these big pieces of hail. Every year, a few are reported. There's never a storm of them. Just one here, one there. With a composition that, when studied, proves that they are natural. They haven't fallen off the wing of a plane. They're natural. But they almost always fall out of clear blue sky. Fact. Just maybe, the angels are practicing so they can show us how ready for the day of judgment. I promised I would finish with a story of me crying while sipping champagne in business class on an aeroplane. And here we are. I'm going to show you a video clip in a minute from a very stupid movie. But when I saw it, it made me cry. I was traveling back from a youth conference in New Zealand. I'd been pushed up to business class, which made me feel, you know, as a young person, I must have been in my early 20s. I felt pretty good about myself. Business class. And the hostess came down, and person in front, would you like champagne? Yes, thank you. Person next to me, would you like champagne? Comes to me, would you like orange juice, Sonny? Yeah. I have champagne, thank you. Trying to prove myself to be worthy of business class. And then they put this movie on, and I sat watching this movie crying unashamedly in business class after having tried to prove what a big, tough person I was. And I think as you watch the bit that I'm going to share with me, you'll understand. And I'm hoping that this will, I guess, serve to color your vision and inspire your service in praying and in believing. And perhaps more than anything, this will help you with your preaching before this terrible day. Because what I want to show you is, well, what I saw was a vision of the things that will happen as the Battle of Armageddon gets underway. This is almost, well, you know, it feels prescient now. We see that some of this stuff are weather reports all the time. But the intensity of this, and the focus, and the way things just kind of grow, I felt as I was watching this like I was watching the Battle of Armageddon unfold, and I was seeing the great and terrible weapons that will be used in the great day of Yahweh. I felt like I was seeing the tools that will be placed at our disposal to judge a world that is at war with God. And it made me cry because, well, it's pretty scary stuff. And as I watched it, it made me want to talk more loudly with the people around me, the people at work and the people at school, about the things that are coming. Because I don't want them to have to face this. I don't want them to have to see the things that are coming. I want them to be on his side, not our side, his, in that day, protected from these terrible events. Because you and I will be safe. These things hold no fear for us. Because we are with him who, in the day of the great storm, said, "Peace be still," and it just was. And the sea and the waves and the wind, they obey him. And in that day they will obey us too. And it won't feel like that to the world around them. In that day, it's a great and fearful day. It's described as the day when the towers fall. And just watching these things unfold reminds me that I want this over fast. How long? Are we nearly there yet? We really want to see the other side of these things. We know that this is a necessary thing because the world hasn't listened. Christ has been calling out for 2,000 years. For 2,000 years he's been saying, "Come to me." Time's almost up. And when it's up, these are the things that will begin to happen. So come, Lord Jesus.